Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
I want to ask you about choice. What about choice? Is the brain hijacked by the predisposition, or is it choice? And what about choice?
I think that the brain is not hijacked. I think it's more like you fell in love with a drug as opposed to a person. And when you fall in love, your behavior gets skewed towards that person in some ways that can sometimes be a bit crazy, just the way people can be a bit crazy about seeking drugs. And you can see the exact same behavior in people who are in love that is somehow thwarted and in people who are addicted. I mean, you can even see like withdrawal symptoms when people get dumped. So does this mean that you have no choice but to have an affair, or you have no choice but rob a drugstore or something? No, it just means that you have a skewed valuation system in your brain that makes you more likely to make that choice than you would be otherwise.
Shocking. There is no other way to put it. Just the idea of someone shooting a needle laced with heroin into their vein is enough to make one shiver. Yet, more and more Americans are in fact shooting up and getting addicted to other drugs as well. Today on the Helicaster Jane Show, we talk to a woman who herself was a heroin addict, who turned her life around and is now considered one of the premier American journalists covering addiction and drugs. Her name is Maya Zalovitz. Her story, compelling. Her new book, Sparking Controversy, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. Maya will be with me in a moment, but first, welcome. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. The Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And while you're there, explore our ads and support the show with a click on the links offered. We want to welcome our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Former heroin user Maya Zalovitz is one of the premier American journalists covering addiction and drugs. Her book, Help at Any Cost, was the first book-length expose of the tough love business that dominates addiction treatment, particularly for teens. Her work often appears in publications such as the New York Times, Scientific American, Elle, Vice, and New York Magazine, among others. She's a 2015-2016 Soros Justice Fellow. In her new book, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, Zalovitz is sparking controversy, forcing the addiction movement to reassess some of its long-held beliefs. What better time to take a look at itself? Addiction is rampant in our society, with heroin and painkiller overdoses dominating headlines and more Americans fighting addictive behavior than ever. With marijuana legalization almost certain to spread domestically, and with the UN considering softening international drug laws for the first time, clarity on this issue is desperately needed. Let's talk.
Maya, I have many friends in Alcoholics Anonymous with whole lot of years of sobriety. And when I told them about your new book, I'm not going to lie, I heard, she's a quack. She's a charlatan. She's dangerous. She's a quack. She's, oh gosh, right? She's messing with the minds of addicts. In other words, Maya, with Unbroken Brain, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction, you know that you're up against an entrenched belief in the addiction movement, not to mention a business model that has worked for many, and you might be messing with the brains of recovering addicts, according to some of those people. What say you?
Well, I'd like to say first, I am in no way opposed to 12-step programs, and I think that the people for whom they work fabulously. People should just go on doing what works for them. What I am saying is that the example I tend to use is about cancer. If you have cancer, your oncologist and your support group are very different people. And in addiction treatment, unfortunately, we've conflated the two. But I'm not an expert on brain cancer because I've had brain surgery. And simply going through addiction recovery does not make you an expert on all things addiction. So I think the problem has been that we have people who think that they are qualified to treat mental illness and all kinds of other things that accompany addictions. And they've been given this authority by a treatment system, which actually violates AA's own AIDS tradition and charges for what you can get for free in any church basement. I'm just saying we should let treatment be treatment, let AA be AA, and let everyone live happily ever after.
So I want to start with the definition of addiction, at least the old version of what the definition of addiction is, what you might call at least an old way of thinking. Talk to me.
There are many different ways of defining addiction, and in the past, it has been primarily focused on having physical dependence on something and suffering withdrawal symptoms when you no longer have access to the substance. The problem with that definition is that it makes cocaine not addictive and makes Prozac addictive. And lots of people would argue that that is a terrible way to define addiction for that reason, since everybody post-crack knows that cocaine is seriously addictive. So when you quit cocaine, you may be irritable and anxious and all kinds of things like that, but you're not puking and shaking in the obvious way that you would be when you quit heroin or alcohol. And so people sort of took that to be the model for all addictions, and hence we got in the 80s, cocaine is not addictive, which is definitely not true. With Prozac, on the other hand, I probably am physically dependent on Prozac in the sense that if I stop taking it, I will probably get depressed again. Does this mean I'm addicted to Prozac? I'm not compulsively using it despite negative consequences, which is my definition and the DSM's definition of addiction. So I would argue no.
Okay. So say this again. Your definition of addiction is?
Compulsive behavior despite negative consequences.
Okay. And let's clarify. If you succumb to addiction, does that make you weak, a victim of your own compulsions, or simply ill, or D, all of the above?
I would say it means that you have learned to love the wrong thing and that you have a learning disorder. If you want to call a learning disorder a disease, some people would argue with you, but I will not. I do not believe addiction is a choice. I am not saying people with addiction are bad people. I am just saying that the way the disease concept has been framed has basically supported drug policy that harms people with addiction. Because right now, addiction is the only disease that is treated with criminalization or faith-based treatment. And when people see a condition treated unlike anything else in medicine, and people are trying to argue it's a disease, but the treatment is prayer and confession, people are going to be like, it's not really a disease. It's obviously a moral problem.
Interesting. Moral problem. Before we get into that, I think we need to define this learning disorder. Everybody's got a learning disorder these days.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I see it as having your brain wired somewhat differently. And the important characteristics of this are that these conditions tend to occur at a certain point in development. For example, autism appears in early childhood typically. Schizophrenia appears in, you know, adolescence and early adulthood. And it tends to be specific to one form of learning. So if you have ADHD, you have problems with attention, but you don't have necessarily problems with intelligence overall. dyslexia obviously is a very specific problem with reading. There's dyscalculia, which I may have mispronounced, but that is a similar problem with math. But basically, these are things that are differences during development that can cause problems, but that also are sometimes associated with gifts as well.
Okay, but so this interests me because when you say, first of all, learning disorder, first of all, the word disorder kind of, I don't quite get that, but could two people growing up in the same house in the same family, right, who mm-hmm. were being taught similarly, at least at home, of course, life experience kind of messes people up because different things happen to different people at different times. But in couching all of this under learning disorder, I'm still not exactly clear why A has it versus B doesn't.
Well, genetics is a big piece.
Okay, so that's something we need to talk about.
You know, I mean, like, people don't develop autism because of bad parenting. I hope nobody would believe that these days. You know, most of these conditions have strong genetic influences, and they also have environmental influences in some cases. In the case of addiction, severe childhood trauma is very much implicated in a lot of addiction. Two-thirds of people with addiction have at least one severely traumatic experience, and the more traumatic your childhood, the higher your risk is for addiction.
So there's a
big connection between trauma and addiction, and there's also a big connection between addiction and other learning disorders and other psychiatric illnesses.
I'm going to say this. This is kind of out there, but you're a smart woman. I know you're going to go. You can understand where I'm going with this because it's something that I have come to understand, and I do think that when you suffer severe abuse, for instance, it actually can almost literally change your DNA.
Well, yeah, epigenetically, that is accurate. There is a bunch of research that shows that early life trauma and lack of nurture actually turns on different sets of genes than a more nurturing childhood would. And that makes a lot of evolutionary sense because if an animal is going to be facing a very stressful world, you want the genes that work best under stress to be on, whereas if the animal is going to be facing a sort of more nurturing and predictable world, you want the genes that work in those situations on. And unfortunately for people who have child trauma, the genes that work best when you're under stress can sometimes limit your cognitive abilities. Fortunately, a lot of this is reversible. But people are smarter when they feel safe and comfortable, basically.
Yeah. You've been very honest about your own history of addiction, and I want to talk about it. I want to use you as a model, right? Why not, right? So I want to talk about from the beginning. I want you to tell us about your family history and your early childhood. Was it a happy or an unhappy beginning? Did you as a child have behavior disorders that showed up early? Or is there anything in your history that would is a clue to your own road
absolutely.
To drug abuse? You know, give us a background on that. I think it's fascinating.
I'll just put it this way. When I was 3 years old in 1968, I was put on Ritalin. It was only very briefly, and it was because I was sort of overwhelmed by sensory experience, like lights were too bright, sounds were too loud, I couldn't deal with new tastes or textures, I didn't like to be touched. Today, I probably would have been diagnosed as Asperger's, but that diagnosis didn't exist back then, so I got the ADHD label. But it was also clear when I was three in 1968, I was also reading. So I was a smart kid, and so a lot of my oddness was sort of put down to intelligence. I was very isolated and lonely. I would not say I had a bad childhood, though, because I really enjoyed my intellectual obsessions. I was really into, like, opera and science fiction. I wanted to be a symphony conductor for a while. I would just get into these intellectual obsessions very, very deeply and sort of lose myself in them. But unfortunately, I also came to believe that I was a bad person because I was much more interested in these obsessions than I was in other people. And that made me a target of bullies because I was always talking about weird things and I was socially clueless. And so, you know, so I stood out very early.
So the clue here is not fitting in.
Basically, yeah. I mean, and if you look at the data that, you know, the research that follows people, what they call longitudinally over time, you'll see that, like, the people on the extremes are the ones at the highest risk. Now, they could be on the opposite extreme. For example, a very, very shy, anxious kid is kind of the opposite of a very bold, courageous kid, but both of them are at higher risk. And this is why the idea of an addictive personality breaks down, because a lot of people have one or two traits that raise risk, but very few people have all of them, and some of them are opposite to each other, so it would be sort of a very difficult personality to have.
Interesting. Listen, I never thought I'd ask a former drug user to use their experience to qualify their thesis, but here we go, right? Tell us about your introduction to drugs and how you progressed to the use of heroin and cocaine use.
Well, I will say this. It was the 80s. I come from Generation X, which is the druggiest generation in history, not the boomers. And in 1978 to 82, which is when I was in high school, those were the peak years of drug use in America. In fact, at around that time, 50% of young adults tried cocaine. And that's not just in New York City. That's an astonishing figure. That's from the National Household Survey on Drug Use and Health. And, you know, these are large national surveys that have been conducted annually for a really long time. So this is kind of like the best data we have. So there was a lot of drug use going on. And I remember just sort of being in, I don't know, seventh grade and having drug education and being told that, you know, peers are going to pressure you to do drugs. And I thought, well, that must mean that drugs are cool. So if I'm going to be able to be cool, I'm going to have to do some drugs. And I they gave you this information alcohol makes you physically out of control and cigarettes cause cancer. But marijuana sounded really interesting. So I decided that if I ever was peer pressured, I would go for the marijuana. And then, of course, I was actually at that time still so socially isolated that nobody would pressure me. But when I got to high school, I found friends that were involved with psychedelics, which I had become sort of fascinated by at the time. And I got into the whole Grateful Dead scene. And that was where I was introduced to cocaine, actually.
So for a smart girl, not so smart.
Well, yes, although, you know, the thing is, and I think this is really important. For one, there's a lot of data showing that smart people are more likely to try drugs than other people. And I think the reason for this is that intellectual openness and curiosity is often associated with intelligence, which also makes you at risk for trying things that you should not try. The other thing I want to point out in terms of this is just that if kids are, you know, sort of experimenting with things, the vast majority of them do not become addicted.
I know that that's part of what you talk about in the book, and I hold off on that for a second because there's another question I want to ask you. You wound up shooting heroin, what, 30, 40 times a day?
And some people have been disbelieving of that, and I want to say that was not what I was doing every day, but there were certainly days, and I mean, it was the coke that was much more compulsive, and I had, because we were selling coke, I had coke around all the time, so, you know, I would just shoot up every 10 minutes. And so you can easily get up to those kinds of numbers if you're doing that.
And I get that. I totally get that. But I have to ask you about heroin use. First of all,
sure.
Heroin use today has reached epidemic proportions in so many cities and towns. It's just insane.
Absolutely.
It's a very cheap drug to get versus probably when you were doing it, it was probably a whole lot more expensive. But help me understand this. Why would a seemingly intelligent, young, well-educated person, knowing what they know about heroin, and yes, I know you say that not all people who shoot heroin become addicted, but many do. Why would you even risk that first time putting a needle in one's arm? I don't even get that. That to me right there is you're a little wacko.
You know, the thing that people need to understand, first of all, I started by snorting it.
Okay.
But I felt, you know, I felt like I had been lied to about drugs. I was told that marijuana was going to make me insane and that, you know, once I took X amount of acid, you know, my brain would be gone. And basically, I was told a lot of propaganda about drugs. So I didn't necessarily believe stuff, you know, that I heard about it anymore. Did I realize that heroin was dangerous? I mean, first of all, I was also told that cocaine was not addictive. And that was such a popular belief in the 1980s that in 1982, I believe it was, Scientific American said that powder cocaine is no more addictive than potato chips. Of course, now we think potato chips are especially addictive, but back then that was seen as an outrageous statement, especially since that was sort of right before crack began taking off. So the cultural climate around it was different. At that time, though, heroin was seen as a very, very dire and deadly and, you know, serious drug that could kill you. And I knew that, but I had just been suspended from Columbia, and I thought my life was over anyway, so I basically was like,
okay.
Don't care anymore.
All right, and that's, I think that's an important point to raise, because I think we have to understand just how this process works, you know?
Well, and despair is a huge part of we're seeing so much heroin use today. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of times, you know, people have this idea that, like, oh, you go to a doctor and you get turned into an addict. And that really isn't what happens. Like, 75% of the time, people who are misusing prescription drugs are misusing somebody else's prescription. So these people are not pain patients. They are recreational drug users, and they have become sort of serious, heavy recreational drug users who are into experimenting with various pills because the middle class is falling apart. They don't really have much hope for the future. And, you know, we're seeing sort of a similar thing in the white community to the despair that was seen in the black community during the crack epidemic. And so we're seeing epidemic levels in white people now.
Right. A couple of things I just quickly wanted to refer to. For me, listen, they told me shoot heroin, deal with heroin, snort heroin, you're getting addicted. That was enough for me. I never went down that road, and I was a child of the drug years, too. Who wasn't? Okay, there's that. And then the second thing is, I have to ask you this. When you did get into heavy heroin use, is there something to the ritual of it that is part of the addiction?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. And, you know, I was always a very compulsive person anyway. I think, you know, like, I have been diagnosed with OCD, which I probably think is, at this point, is probably more of a Aspie thing than a actual OCD, but who knows, the symptoms are the same.
Right.
But yes, it you know, it was definitely, you know, it was the thing for me about heroin, and the reason heroin is attractive to people is that if you have this kind of oversensitivity to emotions and stimulation, it chills that out. It makes you feel loved and safe and warm, and everybody wants to feel that way. Now, I want to qualify that by saying that this is only the case for about 30% of people who take opiates. The rest of people who take opiates are kind of like, they're either awful or they're kind of meh. So you have to be a person who gets this feeling from opiates, and that is not all people. And that's important to realize, because that's a good thing. And that means that, you know, if you do happen to need them for pain, your odds of getting addicted are relatively low. But, you know, the thing is that for those people who love them, they are much more likely to be addictive, which sounds kind of obvious, but isn't, you know, people just sort of have this impression that anybody who tries it gets this amazing euphoria. And a lot of people who try it just get this feeling of, oh, I feel horribly numb and disconnected from the world, and this is awful. And I find it kind of comparable to the way that people react to antidepressants. Like, I take Prozac, and it gives me a little bit of distance and a little bit of sort of separation and a little bit less oversensitivity. Another person might take it and feel like, I'm numb, I have no feelings, it's awful. It all depends on your baseline.
Hmm. That is interesting. Let's go down just a little bit more of this thing so that people understand the difference between somebody who is addictive and somebody who isn't. And I think that that is critical to everything that you're writing about in this wonderful book of yours. That sense of euphoria, the first time you felt it?
Yes.
Right? Changed your world. Changed your world. Had to have changed your world, because everything before that, you never felt that good.
I mean, yeah, like it's a very weird thing, because it did, you know, I was always just, for some reason, I couldn't take in the like love and affection that people actually had for me. And I had extremely high levels of self-hatred, because I just thought, you know, because I couldn't connect, I was bad. And a lot of my recovery has been about getting rid of that self-hatred so that it's not so unbearable to be who I am. And once you get rid of sort of hating yourself and hating yourself for hating yourself, which is the real killer, you can then, you know, it's then not so painful to be in your own skin, and then you don't need the drugs anymore. So, you know, what I tried to do in the book, you know, addiction is about kind of iterative learning, where like you learn something and then like it gets embedded, and then you learn something else, and it sort of, you know, grows on itself. So it's very, you know, there are certain things that like kids will think about themselves that a parent would never want their child to think, but you don't know that they're thinking it because they never express it.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, my parents were like not bad parents. They were, you know, excellent parents. My dad did have depression because he was a Holocaust survivor, which is not surprising. You'd have depression.
Of course.
Also Hungarian, which has high rates of depression anyway. And my mom, you know, was sort of dealing with the 70s and being a woman and, you know. So I don't know. I don't blame them. I don't think that, you know, I mean, yes, you get your genes from your parents, but
you can't blame a parent for your genes.
But, you know, I think that, you know, I interpreted my experience in ways that was painful. And so then I faced that pain and was very isolated from people. I mean, I really wish that I had been diagnosed with Asperger's or something as a child. My parents never let me know about the ADHD diagnosis until I was working on this book, in fact. But I wish I had known that because I hopefully would have thought that I was just sick, not bad.
Yeah, no, I get that. You know, those days we didn't tell our children what we tell them these days. So here's another important part of your story that I think is also part of this whole concept that you've come up with. And that is, how did you get to sobriety? And was it intervention, readiness, the courts, which you had gone through that mess? Is it the old adage that you have to hit bottom in order to recover? Is that true? Right.
No,
you know what I'm saying? So let's go there. Let's talk about this. Because I know a lot of people not only who did never recovered, but wound up dying from.
Well, and that's, yeah. I mean, I think the concept of bottom is terrible and can be deadly. Because the problem is that it's really a turning point in a tale of sin and redemption. It's not a scientific concept. It's a concept that can only be defined retrospectively. So, like, if I say I hit bottom and then I relapse, well, then I have a new bottom, and then you get to bottoms with trap doors and all kinds of nonsense like this. So the reality about addiction for most people is that it's not that they haven't suffered enough. It's that they don't have any hope of any alternative. For me also, I recovered when I was 23, and I feel like a lot of what happened, you know, I had been arrested 2 years prior to that, and I was, like, using drugs even more because I was so stressed out about potentially being in prison for 15 years. So that obviously didn't deter me, and it certainly should have if I had been thinking rationally. So, you know, the thing of addiction is it's defined as compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. So if punishment worked to fix it, it kind of wouldn't exist. So this is part of why the idea of bottom is so dangerous, because there are people that you can just punish and punish and punish, and they'll just get worse and worse and worse until they die. What people with addiction actually need is love and support and being told that you can get better.
So is that what happened with you? Somebody actually broke through and you were able to get it? Is there an aha moment?
Like, you know, I actually did do the 12-step thing because it was the only thing that was offered to me. I decided, you know, one day I realized that, you know, the drugs weren't working. My life was getting worse. I was about to do things that horrified me. And so I called my parents and asked to go into treatment. And I'd been resistant to treatment for a really long time because I thought accurately that treatment often involves breaking people down, trying to force them to hit bottom by humiliating and attacking them. And that was basically my worst nightmare. That was why I was doing drugs, to escape, you know, feeling socially isolated and scapegoated. So the idea that that would be treatment was horrifying to me. And the fact that that is treatment in so many cases is still horrifying to me. In fact, I wrote an earlier book about where that idea comes from and why that is harmful. But anyway, fortunately, I went to a reasonably non-confrontational rehab, and it was your sort of traditional 28-day 12-step-based program. And because I was told by doctors and authorities that this is the only way you can recover, I embraced it. And I found some stuff in it very, very useful. I also found some stuff in it, you know, problematic, because, you know, people would say everything happens for a reason. And be like, really? Like, God put the Holocaust in my father's path for a reason? Like, I just can't go there.
Right. I get it. I totally get it. Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, I can't say that this is the only way I could have possibly recovered the way some people say about the 12 steps, because I don't have like 20 identical twins who went through different versions. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So I just can't, you know, I can't say that. I can just say that, like, I know that the thing that was helpful for, you know, the things that seemed to be to make the difference for me were getting a sense of hope, getting a sense that, you know, I could be capable of loving and being loved, and that I could potentially find my way back into the life that I had originally thought of myself as having. So, you know, it was really hope. And it was also, I think, you know, I was 23 when I got into recovery, and that's an age when the frontal cortex of the brain is sort of finishing development. So it's possible that the reason that I got into recovery at that point was nothing to do with what I was thinking, and a lot to do with the fact that now I was capable of not, of saying no, of resisting urges, and of actually getting better, because that frontal area that, you know, is responsible for self-control was finally developed.
Right. You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. My guest today is the author of Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, Maya Solovitz. Stay with us. Hi, this is Hallie Kasser Jane. Are you enjoying the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. And we are back on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. My guest today is the author of Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, Maya Solovitz. A little rat hole. Let's go down this one real quickly. There is a longstanding belief that drug use is progressive smoke grass, and you know it's a slippery slope, baby, to hard drugs. What are your thoughts?
You know, I kind of, you know, most Hell's Angels started with tricycles, but that doesn't mean every tricyclist is a future Hell's Angel. You know, correlation is not cause. And I think the more likely explanation for the fact that you do see this somewhat typical progression is that, first of all, most people do not progress. But second of all, that you start with the things that are most available. And then if you're interested in drugs, just like if you're interested in wine, you're not going to just try Bordeaux. You're going to go for some Sauvignon Blancs. And some people who are interested in an area obsessively are going to want to try different aspects of that area. So I think, and people who are desperate for escape are going to try multiple routes for escape. So I think, you know, that's a really important way of understanding it, because the idea that, you know, something's a stepping stone to other things, like, why? Like, first of all, like, you know, I mean, if you look at, like, in Holland, where they've had basically quasi-legal marijuana for a really long time, fewer people go on to harder drugs, which is, of course, the opposite of what you would expect if making it more available would create a gateway effect. So if there is a gateway effect, the one that there is would be, oh, I sell marijuana. I also sell coke. Would you like to try it?
Fascinating, yeah.
So that's completely social. But I think that, you know, if you look at the people who get addicted to whatever, like whether it's sex, drugs, rock and roll, or carrots, yes, you can actually get addicted to carrots. People tend to have pre-existing issues. And the people who don't have pre-existing mental illness or personality disorders or trauma or some combination of all of those things, or just severe despair, if you don't have those things, you know, maybe you might have some extreme gene that makes you overwhelmingly likely to get addicted if you meet a particular drug, but usually you can tell why some people get addicted.
You do this brain scan trip in the book. Don't want to give all the story away, because she tells you at the end what the story is. But I do want to ask you this. I mean, is there or could there be a way that diagnostics could actually tell? I mean, if we start doing medicine and we treat, you know, mental health as part of our everyday routine when we go to the doctor, which we don't right now, it's like the last thing that comes in. You know, show us your symptom and then we'll treat you. Not, you know, let's just see whether or not this is something that we can see is going to happen to you in the future according to these criteria. And if we do certain tests and we have them on, you know, on you,
will know. Will there ever be a way to know who is going to lean to be a more addictive person? And I want to talk about that because I'm using these terms and I know I'm walking a fine line because you don't see.
No, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
You're asking it. You know, can we predict which 3-year-old on the playground?
Right.
I mean, and I don't think you can predict what problem the 3-year-old is going to have, but you can predict which 3-year-olds are going to have some sort of problem. And you can probably help them with that. And there's an interesting prevention program that I write about in the book where what they do is they give kids tests for outlying personality traits like impulsivity or anxiety. And what they do not tell the kids that this is what they're doing, but they test them. And the ones who are outliers on these traits are offered a special class that will help them succeed, you know, and it seems like a special thing, like it doesn't seem like a you are stigmatized thing. And so they get, if they're impulsive, they get basically cognitive behavioral therapy to reduce acting on impulse. And if they're anxiety sensitive, they get, you know, CBT around that. And if they're depressed. So it's basically like trying to get in there before the kid has spent 20 years ruminating on how horrible they are. And I believe that if you had prevented that sort of horrible cognitive pattern that I got into, or if I'd maybe had antidepressants as a teenager, I don't think the addiction, you know, I might not be in this career at all.
Right.
My addiction may have never developed. So I think the, you know, can you tell which kid is going to be an addicted person and which kid is going to be a depressed person and which depressed person will become an addict or not? You know, I don't think you'll be able to do necessarily that fine-grained thing. I mean, it's interesting because there are some genes that seem to predispose you to things as diverse as autism and schizophrenia. So, you know, are you predisposed to have some kind of potential problem? Yes. Can we potentially reduce the odds that you will actually develop that problem? Also, yes. So, I mean, I think the other thing is that kids who have really bad sensory issues, a lot of people are now treating that early, and I think that's going to help a lot.
You know, something that's, I think, really supports what you're saying, that it's more of a learning disorder than anything, is how it goes against really part of your argument, but it goes for it too, which is if you talk about it being addiction being a gene issue, maybe not so much a gene issue as a behavior that runs throughout one particular family, which is why you see it happening generation within generation, at least in terms of alcoholism and maybe in drug abuse as well, that it's a learned behavior because it goes from generation to generation. Can we go back and look at the genes? Do we know enough about gene understanding our genes to understand whether there's some little click that goes in there that
Well, it's clearly the case that there's a genetic predisposition to a variety of addictions. Again, that same predisposition might also predispose you to depression. Like there was just a discovery of a marijuana addiction related gene that also predisposes to depression. You know, these are tiny effects at this point. So we don't have a gene for this or a gene for that, and that wouldn't make any sense. What you probably have is, say, a gene that makes you super sensitive to emotions or that, you know, dysregulates your ability to control your response to emotions. And that might set you up to get bullied because you react a lot. And then when you get bullied, you get depressed.
Yeah, but I also do think it's fair to say that there is learning disorders can be taught in homes. Because it runs through, all you can give your children is what you know. You know.
Yes, I mean that's definitely true. And this is why it's so complicated and hard to talk about.
Right.
Because it's like to separate out the genetics from the learning is really, really difficult. And this is why, like, you know, I think it's kind of silly to argue like is addiction genetic or environmental? It's both. It's obviously both. It's a spiral that leads you from one to the other that
right.
ends you up in it.
So let me move further because I've got a lot more questions and that time is going quickly. I want to ask you about choice. What about choice? Is the brain hijacked by the predisposition or is it choice? And what about choice and whether
I think that the brain is not hijacked. I think it's more like you fell in love with a drug as opposed to a person. And when you fall in love, your behavior gets skewed towards that person in some ways that can sometimes be a bit crazy. just the way people can be a bit crazy about seeking drugs. And you can see the exact same behavior in people who are in love that is somehow thwarted and in people who are addicted. I mean, you can even see like withdrawal symptoms when people get dumped. So I think that, you know, does this mean that you have no choice but to have an affair or you have no choice but to like, you know, rob a drugstore or something? No. It just means that you have a skewed valuation system in your brain that makes you more likely to make that choice than you would be otherwise.
And let me take it out on this one. Should we be judging addicts? Should we be saying they are the lowest of the low? They're the liars, they're manipulators, they're selfish, they're lacking empathy. Should we be judging, or is it time, as part of what your new findings are showing, should we have a different point of view towards our addicts?
Well, I think that, for one, yes, there are about 18% of people with addiction who have a personality disorder called antisocial personality disorder, which makes them tend to lack compassion and tend to lie and manipulate. 82% of us do not have that personality disorder. And in fact, the lying and the hiding that goes on around addiction is very similar to the lying and hiding that goes on around affairs that people have. It's not a nice thing to do, obviously, but it's not a sign of some, you know, greater defect. It's just human. We tend to try to get the things that we think are essential to our survival, and oftentimes that is involving reproduction or food, or if you've fallen in love with a drug as opposed to a person, the drug. So I think what happens there is that, you know, people get their decision-making paths skewed, but the idea that, you know, all people with addiction are callous, unempathetic, you know, liars and manipulators, well, the data doesn't support that, and it's a racist stereotype. It comes from the racism that created the war on drugs. If you look at the beginnings of the drug war, they're all about labeling people that white people didn't like in ways that are very similar to the way that we label people with addiction today. And, you know, if you make something illegal, people are going to be dishonest about it.
Well, you're going to do what you have to do to also to get your fix. I mean, there's that too. Back to this, I want to talk about current modalities for treatment. There are a whole lot of people who have achieved long-term sobriety under the current models, and you're not against AA, as you said. But if we look at this as a learning disorder, how does that change treatment modalities?
Well, I think for one, it is insane to have 80% of our treatment be basically indoctrinating you into 12-step groups. I really think that's got to stop. I think that when you go to treatment, what you should get is cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been proven to be as effective as 12-step stuff, but without the problematic aspects, or motivational enhancement therapy, which again, compared to 12-step stuff, works equally well, but faster. So basically, I think that what treatment should be is basically psychoeducation. And if you have coexisting disorders, you need to be treated for them. And if you have trauma, you need to be, you know, helped to deal with that. And I think we need to expand the spectrum of treatment so that people who are, you know, still using can get help. The idea of harm reduction is that, you know, we meet you where you're at. And there are some people that are so traumatized and so ill that you can't take away their primary means of coping before you put something else in place. And so those people are going to need to be helped while they're still using.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, so treatment should be compassionate, supportive, and kind and respectful, just the way good schools are. It should involve a complete medical and psychiatric evaluation because, you know, for example, with ADHD, which is another learning disorder, you might need medication.
Right.
And so, you know, it needs to be complete, and people do need social support. And one great source of social support for some people is 12-step programs. So they should be an option, and people should be told that they exist and given, you know, meeting books and everything like that. But you shouldn't be paying for people to be teaching you the steps in treatment. That does not make any sense. It basically makes people pay for stuff that, you know, the 12-step programs themselves say should be given away for free.
Yeah. I'm going to interrupt again because I think the point was made, and I want to move it forward. But I want to say this to you. I want to say that this punitive approach got to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
It ain't working, and it's not solving problems. It's something that I'm dying to ask you this. So many people are addicted to so many things right now. It's like the whole world is like a massive addiction. We're addicted to sugar. We're addicted to fat. We're addicted to sex. We're addicted to pornography. Did you think about this when you were writing this book?
Yes,
did you think, having a massive disorder here? Is there something in our society that is just so screwed up that we're not dealing with? But the bottom line is maybe we need to start dealing with that. That it's even more than the individual approach, but there's a global kind of thing going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, hello, inequality. you know, I mean, we have a terrible, I'm sorry about that noise, but it's, we have a absolutely terrible problem with inequality, and this exacerbates every single health problem you can imagine, whether it's childhood trauma or, you know, addiction or obesity or diabetes and all these other things that can come out of people's attempts to deal with feeling, you know, less than. So, yes, I think that, you know, capitalism thrives on creating addictions. And this is not to say we shouldn't have capitalism, but it is to say that we need to take the edges off of it so that people can thrive. I mean, the antidote to most psychological problems ultimately is social connection. This is not to say that that is always the only thing that's needed, but without social connection, it is almost impossible to be happy and healthy.
And maybe the rise of the internet has a lot to do with this, just everybody being so out of sorts. Isn't that a nice way to put it?
It's interesting because the internet can go both ways. Like, it can, you know, help people who are really isolated because they're like aspy and obsessed with like one particular thing to find each other. So that's good. But on the other hand, it can make all of us like really disconnected and comparing ourselves to others and that kind of thing. So I think it's both connecting and disconnecting at the same time, which makes it very hard to.
But I also think this, there is if you're like a maniac on the internet, which most of us are, right? Because our lives are about it. What's missing? There's no physical touch. There's no emotional touch. There's a wall between everybody, and everybody can put up whatever persona they want to do. I mean, I think that is feeding something that needs to be your next book. There you go. Your next book. It should be, you know, looking at the effects of all of this on behavior and how.
Well, no, I mean, there's definitely, I think there's, you know, there is a lot there. And I mean, the physical touch thing, I think, is really, really important. I think as a society, we are starved for physical affection. And I think part of the reason manicurists are so popular is to get that little massage.
Yeah. It's true. It's a cheap massage. It's kind of sad. But it's fact. I want to talk to you about methadone and methadone-like treatments. Where are you on that? Freely distributing needles. Talk to me.
Okay, so methadone and Suboxone, which is also known as buprenorphine, are the only two treatments that we have that cut the death rate by 50% or more. And that is when they are used indefinitely, perhaps lifelong. So I am absolutely in favor of cutting the death rate in half. And there are many, many people who thrive on these treatments, but who, because the stigma is that, oh, you're still getting high, oh, you're not really in recovery, do not come out about it. So I feel like I have to speak for some of them because they cannot speak for themselves because they would risk their jobs and other things in because of the stigma.
Right.
So I think we've got to stop that stigma. You know, does that mean everybody with opioid addiction should be on methadone or buprenorphine for the rest of their life? Of course not. But if you are on it and it's working for you, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. I hear that. And I think that's a really good point. I want to talk to you about this, too. Moderation. Oy. I don't know. Moderation in addiction. So somehow those two don't seem to go together for me. But someone who might be addicted to sex, can they have a little sex or food, a little food or heroin? Just want one hit and I don't need any more. I mean,
you know, it will vary based on the substance. Obviously, you need to have a little food or you're going to die. I think we can learn a lot from people with food addictions about how to moderate. Because they are forced to, they have no choice. So, you know, I think it is clearly the case that there are some people who meet all the criteria for what was then called alcohol dependence in their 20s and who moderate by their 30s. Like, these people exist. So the thing is that for some people, any drug that they touch, they're going to end up using it excessively. For other people, they just don't like something so much, so they can take it on occasion.
But is that truly an addictive personality? I don't know. That's what you'd have to get into to answer that question.
Like I said, I don't think there is an addictive personality.
Right, but
there
a propensity towards. How's that?
Well, again, you have to like something to be really addicted to it, or it has to solve some problem.
Right, it has to serve you, your needs.
Yeah, so some people just could not get addicted to certain things because they just don't like the experience. So, you know, it will vary depending on what it is. Like, you know, I ain't giving up sugar. I will cut way down, but, you know, life is sweet, man.
Yeah. And you're so funny you say that because I have a tendency, sugar does weird things to me, you know. But you know where and this is something that's a little different, and that is that I prefer not eating it because I don't like what it's doing. And, you know,
right.
So now it's a question of just don't go there because it makes you feel lousy. You know, it makes you feel lousy. So why eat it? Even if for that moment of pleasure, I'm not going to do it.
Again, I think that will be a very individual choice of, you know, what works for a person.
Right. It tells you a little bit about
how to play with it.
Right. I think that gets into what you're talking about in terms of the disorder and how we each think and how we're trained to think. And obviously, that keeps me from being a horribly, you know, unfortunately addictive, although there are things I've been addicted to that have been fun, but I mean, over the years. Listen, a point you raise in the book, this utterly fascinated me. I could have even started our conversation with this, but we're going to kind of end it in a way on this. And that is, babies can be born with a physical dependence on drug like heroin if their mothers were users during the pregnancy, but they themselves can't be addicted. Wow.
I know, that's weird, right?
Right.
But this gets to the heart of why learning is part of addiction. Because the baby doesn't know what, you know, baby gets uncomfortable. Baby might need a diaper change. Baby might be hungry. Baby might be thirsty. Baby might need to be held by mommy. Baby might need opioids. But the baby can't distinguish between those things because it's a baby. And it also can't, learn that the drug fixes me and then pursue that experience despite negative consequences. Now, it's possible when they get older, they may learn such a thing. But as a baby, they can only have the physical dependence part because they're certainly not going to be crawling out of the crib to go and score heroin. And thank goodness for that. But the other piece of that is that, you know, when crack happened in the 80s and 90s, there was a horrible stigma attached to so-called crack babies. And they were said to be, you know, simultaneously the evil criminal predators and also, you know, mentally incapacitated, which kind of seems like they couldn't possibly be both. But anyway, there were these horrible stereotypes about these poor kids. And in some instances, the stereotype was far worse for them than the drug. There's a horrible case that I just can't forget of these four boys who were adopted. And the adoptive parents starved them. And the social workers could see that these kids were emaciated, but they believed the parents' claim that these kids were crack babies and they just wouldn't eat. And the 19-year-old looked like a 4-year-old. He was so thin by the time they intervened and found out that if you just feed these kids, they will grow just fine. So, you know, we have to be really, really careful about how we label children because if you, you know, when there was another horrifying study where if you look at you look at infant behavior and you label one kid a crack baby, suddenly the person looking at that child interprets all their behavior in a negative way and interprets their potential as being less. And you can imagine what that will do to a child over time.
Right. You know, Maya, when we see just how much of society is suffering with addiction, it scares the heck out of me. And I'm not sure that your assertion that addiction is a learning disorder gives me or my listeners solace. It's just a different, you know, interpretation. It's a reason, to be sure. But to my mind, it's also a recognition that society is in deep trouble. I want to get back to that. Leave us with some hope with your findings at the root of your reply. I really want to know.
Sure. Well, I mean, one thing that I think is very promising is that if you look at people, large samples of people that get diagnosed with addictions, half of those people by age 30 are no longer addicted. Tobacco is the exception here. And opioids, you know, obviously, and there are certainly cases that last a lot longer, but half of them will end by 30 with the person alive. And so, you know, the good news is that there's a lot of recovery out there that occurs by people, you know, not doing any 12-step thing or any formal treatment at all. And those people are out there and we need to learn from them about how they did it. Because I think, you know, if addiction is like falling in love and getting dumped by your partner, you know, people get over breakups all the time. How do we do this? In many different individual ways. We need to like be reaching out to each other and being ecumenical about what will help. You know, what helps me may not help you, but it might help somebody else. And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, love and connection are critical to healing is an important insight that, you know, 12-step programs had. We need to honor that and expand that and, you know, help each other and connect with each other in ways that can, you know, reduce the stress of this horrible inequality we're dealing with.
I've been speaking with Maya Zalovitz, author of Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, by way of St. Martin's Press. For more information on Maya, visit her website at mayaz.com. Her book is available at fine bookstores everywhere, at barnesandnoble.com and on amazon.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Cassar-Jane Show. The Hallie Cassar-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Cassar-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieCassarJane.com. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Cassar-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Cassar-Jane Show. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieCassarJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Cassar-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Cassar-Jane. It's a wrap.
It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.